today by talking just a little bit more about signaling using the second messenger IP3 and related matters. And that way we can get rid of everything that's on that handout and we won't have to come back to it. And then we'll go on and talk some more about nerves. Now, if you look at 15B again, at the top we have the standard second messenger pathway for generating cyclic AMP. And as we explained at the end of class last time, there is at least one other similar second messenger pathway. Starts out the same way, that a G protein coupled receptor binds its ligand. And this activates a G protein. But this would be a different protein, a different G protein from the one in the cyclic AMP pathway. And that activates an enzyme associated with the membrane. But as we said before, instead of being adenyl cyclase, this time the protein is phospholipase C. So adenyl cyclase converts cyclic regular AMP to cyclic AMP. Phospholipase C splits a lipid which is already in the membrane. And that's shown on the bottom. And that is, if you look at the second picture, this is glycerol with two fatty acids. This is the glycerol part. These are the two fatty acids. And then it's attached, as in most glycerol-based membrane phospholipids, the third hydroxyl on the glycerol is attached to a phosphate and attached to a base. And in this case, the base is inositol. Now, inositol has a ring with six hydroxyls on it. So once you use one of the hydroxyls to link to the phosphate, there are five more hydroxyls available. So there are five positions here to which it is possible to add phosphate. And the point we made last time is that there are many versions of this. Cells have enzymes for adding and removing phosphates. And depending upon which enzymes are present, active, and inactive, you can get many variants of phosphate. This right here is called phosphatidyl inositol, or just PI. But there are many variants of it, having one, two, three, four additional, actually up to three additional phosphates. Now, the most famous variant, and the one that we're interested in, is that two phosphates are added. So you get what is called usually PIP2, but it has other names as well. Because the PI is the phosphatidyl inositol, and then it's got two more phosphates. And this is embedded in the membrane, so it would be over here with the phosphatidyl inositol sticking out. Now, notice that it's embedded in the lipid. The lipids don't go all the way through, but they go through the cytoplasmic side or leaflet of the bilayer. Now, the point of this PIP2 thing is that it's a phospholipid in the membrane. So that means it's amphipathic. It has a hydrophobic end and a hydrophilic end, which is which here? So this is the hydrophobic end, is it? No. This is the hydrophobic end sticking into the membrane, while this is the hydrophilic end sticking into the cytoplasm. So that's sitting there in the membrane, ready to roll. And when phospholipase C is activated, it splits off the two halves. It splits the two halves apart. Now, that generates IP3, which is a soluble second messenger, like cyclic AMP, that can move through the cytoplasm and activate things. Now, we didn't emphasize it last time, but it also, as it shows on your handout, generates a second messenger, which remains in the membrane but can diffuse through the membrane, and that's diacylglycerol, which is lipid-soluble, while the IP3 is water-soluble. Now, we're mostly interested in this for the water-soluble end. Our main interest here is what IP3 does in the cytoplasm. But it's worth mentioning that the diacylglycerol, or DAG, also is a second messenger and also can activate other proteins. And the protein it usually activates is written on your handout, is protein kinase C. There are three famous classes of protein kinase, A, B, and C. And we've already met protein kinase A. This is protein kinase C. Protein kinase B is involved in other things. And so DAG activates protein kinase C, which is really a family of proteins, all of which are a little different from each other and activated in different ways. And some of them also require calcium. But we're not going to go into the details of this. But I want to look a little bit more about what IP3 does. We said last time, at the very end, that calcium is stored in the endoplasmic reticulum, as written on your handout. And there are channels in the ER. And what IP3 does is cause the opening of these channels so that calcium flows down its concentration gradient into the cytoplasm. Now, why doesn't the calcium stay in the cytoplasm? Remember Dr. Feierstein said calcium is dangerous? Calcium is always pumped away. So the calcium will be either pumped by active transport back into the ER or out of the cell across the plasma membrane. But there'll be a temporary burst of calcium, and that will have an effect. Now, in order to do that, it means that IP3 has to have receptors on the surface of the ER. Now, if we have calcium, what good is that? We've already said that calcium is a signal. Some people call it another second messenger. Some people call it a third messenger. And that one of the things that calcium can do is trigger exocytosis, which is important in release of hormones, release of secreted proteins in general, and release of neurotransmitters. Now, it can have other effects as well. And how does it have an effect? In some cases, calcium binds to some protein and alters its activity, just like it says on the handout. But sometimes calcium needs a middleman in order to have its activity. Another one of those famous proteins is calmodulin. Calmodulin is a calcium-binding protein. And many of the effects of calcium come about because calcium sticks to calmodulin, changes its conformation, and the complex sticks to something else. So just as cyclic AMP has to bind PKA, and then the PKA does something, often calcium has to bind calmodulin, and then the complex does something. The complex is not an enzyme, but it binds to enzymes and either activates or inactivates them. And we'll find an example when we talk about smooth muscle contraction about where calmodulin fits in. So either by plain old calcium or a calcium-calmodulin complex, calcium has big effects, which is the bottom line. Now, there's only one other thing about this whole process of signaling that I want to mention. Our emphasis here is on second messengers. Cyclic AMP is one, calcium is one, IP3 is one, DAG is one. But there's another aspect of signaling with lipids that's important. When you want to get a signal somewhere, a signal binds to a receptor on the surface of the cell, and one thing is to generate a second message inside the cell, and the second messenger travels through the cell to its target and activates or inactivates it. So that's a sort of broadcast method. But an alternative is what people call recruitment. And the idea there is that when you have an activated protein or an active substance, things come to it. It doesn't go to its target. Its target comes and sticks to it. And when the target sticks to it, that target protein is activated or inactivated. So the way that works here is certain variants of phosphatidyl inositol that have additional phosphates seem to recruit proteins. That is, once you add enough phosphates to this compound, it sits here on the surface of the membrane and attracts other proteins. Now, it itself is not a protein, it's a lipid, but it attracts proteins. The proteins stick to the surface of the membrane, become activated, and do their thing. And this turns out to be an important principle because there are a lot of things going on in the cell. And how do you cause something to happen in one locality and not in another? The recruitment allows you to pile up a certain set of activated proteins in one part of the cell and do something in that part of the cell without changing things all over. Now, this is all I wanted to say about the signaling business before going back to nerves. So before I do that, let me ask if you have any questions. Yes?
If we get recruitment, what would be the purpose of the proteins that are recruited?
Well, the proteins, his question is, what's the purpose of the proteins that are recruited? Often they are phosphatases or kinases of some sort. And then, or sometimes they are middlemen that activate other proteins. But eventually some protein sticks, which has enzymatic activity. That enzymatic activity is souped up one way or the other. And then things in that local area are converted by the enzyme. Sometimes it's also involved in the production of structures, such as parts of the cytoskeleton in one part of the cell versus another. So I want to now go back to nerves. And we've talked a lot about how a signal... Now let me ask, is there anyone who does not have a handout for today? Okay, I wasn't sure we had enough this morning. Okay. So I want to look at 16A at the bottom of the question of how you get anything done using nerves. We understand how you have a message that goes down a nerve and how that message is conveyed to the next nerve. We also understand that you have sensors that detect light, heat, stretch, etc., and they convey a message. But how, in response to that message, do you do anything? So you have to have a circuit. So the first thing we have drawn here is the simplest possible circuit, in that it has one neuron going into the central nervous system, and one neuron going out of the central nervous system. So this would actually be inside the spinal cord in this particular example. But the important thing is that this synapse is inside what is called the central nervous system, that is, the brain or the spinal cord. And there is a single synapse here. There are two nerve cells, but only one synapse. Nerve synapse. So this is called a monosynaptic circuit, meaning that it just has one nerve-nerve synapse. However, where does the signal come from? So the example here involves stretch and muscle. So at this end, you have a muscle, it would be actually a skeletal muscle. And the muscle is actually going to do something. It's going to contract or relax. And so it's called an effector. Things like glands that release hormones or muscles are called effectors because they have an effect. They actually do something in response to all these signals. So there is here a synapse of nerve on top of muscle. But we call this monosynaptic because there's only one nerve synapse. That's the main one we're concentrating on. Now, in the muscle, there is a stretch receptor. We talked about these before, briefly. They detect how much pull there is on that muscle, how much weight you're trying to lift, etc. And information about that goes into the central nervous system, and then in response, a message comes out to trigger the muscle to relax, to contract, and to pull back. Now, any nerve that goes into the central nervous system is called afferent. Information flowing in is afferent, and information going out to the effector is efferent. Efferent is to the effector. And of course, you have to get information in before you know what to do. So as they say, A before E. Now in your picture, there's a little thing like this. Because in many neurons outside the central nervous system, the body, the cell body, is not at one end, but the cell body is off to one side. Now, when you have many cell bodies outside the central nervous system, and they're all grouped together in one place, that's called a ganglion. So if you had many nerve cells, their axons would make up the nerve fiber, and their bodies would all be together in a bunch outside the fiber in a ganglion. So this has the cell bodies. Now, in this example we're talking about, the neuron that carries things in, information in, is afferent, and it's also a sensory neuron. So we have an afferent sensory neuron, and it carries information into the central nervous system about how much stretch there is. And then we have a neuron that goes back to that muscle and decides whether it will contract or not. And that's called a motor neuron. A motor neuron carries a message to a skeletal muscle. And as I hope will become clearer as we go on today, it has only one possible message. And that's do it. If an action potential comes down this motor neuron, that will cause the muscle to contract. If no message comes down the motor neuron, the muscle will relax. There is no relax signal. There's either contract or do nothing. Now, this is not true for smooth muscle. Smooth muscle can get a signal to contract or a signal to relax. But skeletal muscle gets only one kind of signal, contract. Otherwise, nothing. So how would this work? Input about stretch would go in the afferent. And here you have a synapse. So neurotransmitter would be released. Now, what kind of synapse is this going to be? Excitatory or inhibitory? It's going to be excitatory because what do we want to happen? If there is stretch, we want a counteracting contraction. So if there is stretch, we want to generate an action potential, which means we want to excite this cell. So it would be receptors would give you, this is an excitatory synapse. So what kind of postsynaptic potential do you get here? This is easy. Excitatory postsynaptic potential. So you release neurotransmitter, and then the local change here in postsynaptic potential is toward threshold so that this cell can become excited. Now, we have put only one input into this nerve cell body. There's additional input because if this is the spinal cord, it means that there are neurons going up and down to the brain. So what this neuron is told to do depends on the information it gets from the muscle plus the information it gets from the brain. But we're only writing one neuron for now. Without any input from the brain, you can get this muscle to contract. You all know that because you've all gone to the doctor and gotten hit by one of those little rubber hammers. And that's producing something very much like this. Okay. Now, this is the simplest possible case. But consider it your average muscle. Most of your muscles come in pairs. And one of them helps you with movement in one way and one in the other. The classic example is these two muscles, which are the biceps and the triceps. That you don't want both of these to contract at the same time. If you do, you'll get trouble. What you want is, if you want to flex the muscle, if you want to flex your arm, you want this one to contract so you can shorten, but that means this one has to relax. If you want to extend your arm, you want this one to relax, but this one to contract and pull. So people sometimes call this one the flexor, because it allows you to flex, and this one the extensor, because it allows you to extend your arm. But the point, bottom line here, is you have a pair of opposing muscles. And you want to send a signal to one to contract and no signal to the other. So it will relax. So to set that up, you need a more complicated system. And that's what your next picture is. It shows you one pair. So what we've done here is to add on another neuron. Actually, we've added several. So to make the room, I'll put them down here. So now we're going to turn it pretty much into picture two. So now we have the pair of muscles. We want one to contract and one to relax. Now, this... So I need another synapse. Now, here we have an afferent neuron. And we have another efferent neuron. What do you call this thing? This is an interneuron. Because it gets input from one neuron and sends it to another neuron. It's in between two other neurons. Now, how's it going to work this time? Suppose we detect stretch in our original muscle. So we get the same result. We stimulate the motor neuron that causes that muscle to contract. Now, how are we going to get this muscle to relax? We want no action potential in this neuron. So that means what kind of synapse should this be? Inhibitory or excitatory? This one should be inhibitory. So notice that our top neuron makes two different synapses. Axons are often branched, and there are synapses on multiple targets. But the neurotransmitter released in both cases is the same. And in this case, the receptors are the same. So both of these are excitatory synapses. But here we have an inhibitory synapse. It could be the same neurotransmitter, but it's probably a different one. And certainly the receptor is different. So what kind of postsynaptic change are we going to get here? Are we going to go toward threshold or away from threshold? We're going to go away from threshold. We're going to hyperpolarize. So what ions could do that? Presumably either chloride is going in or potassium is going out. What ions are moving here? We want the cell to be more positive inside, and that's almost always sodium. But if we're opening sodium channels, are they ligand-gated or voltage-gated? Let's take a vote. right here. Ligand gated, voltage gated, undecided. Okay, what about here?
Voltage.
This is an action potential, so these are voltage gated. But over here, they're ligand gated, because it's the neurotransmitter from the presynaptic cell that is opening the channels here. And so the local change in potential, the excitatory postsynaptic potential, diffuses around the cell, and if there's enough of it, here at the axon hillock, will actually trigger an action potential. And now we'll open voltage-gated sodium channels. So as a result of this, one of the muscles gets the signal to contract, and the other gets no signal, and therefore relaxes. Now, in a real picture, we need another set, because there have to be two neurons going to this one, just as there are two neurons going to the top one. Because when you detect stretch in the bottom muscle, you have to, in fact, cause that one to contract and make the other one relax. So I've only drawn one half of it here. I'm missing more pieces, but it gets out of hand if you draw all the pieces. Okay. So let me ask again if there are questions before we go on. Yes?
Where is that interneuron located in relation to the spinal cord?
So where is this? This would be in the spinal cord. Most of the neurons in the central nervous system are actually interneurons. Now, in this case, all of this would be in the spinal cord. I've blown up this part. It would have to be much smaller. Yes?
Our diagram only shows a ganglion onto one of the nerves. Would that be...
As far as I know, the cell bodies of this one, the cell bodies of motor neurons are not in a ganglion. Where is the body? In fact, the cell body of the motor neuron is in the spinal cord. Yeah. Let me just say one more thing. If I put the second sensory neuron down here, because there's a sensory neuron here, but I left it off, where would its body be? It would be in a ganglion, so there'd be another ganglion for that. Yeah?
Does the stretch receptor also cause an action potential?
Yes, otherwise there is no way of getting a message down this neuron. So stretch is one of these one-cell systems where you generate a local change, graded potential in this part, which leads to an action potential in the rest of it. Yes?
Is that whole circuit considered self-correct conduction, or is it just the path down the axon?
He's asking about saltatory conduction. I think that's only when you go down a myelinated axon, which is only part of it. But I think almost all the entire axon is myelinated. Other question? Oh, yeah.
Would the cell body of the other sensory neuron be in the same gate?
Would the sensory neuron of this other sensory neuron be in the same ganglion? I don't know what the real setup is. I think so, actually. There's a picture, I think, in a Sadhava of what this really looks like, which I think might be clearer. Yeah. Okay. Now, this is a simple circuit. Well, not quite so simple circuit. And now I want to look not at an individual circuit, but the organization of the nervous system overall. And that's on the top of your handout. So let's look at that. So here we have the central nervous system. Of course, it doesn't look like that, but it's symbolized just by a circle, and that represents the spinal cord in the brain. So we now know that there's afferent information coming in and efferent information coming out. So the way we've drawn it on your picture, everything on the top here is afferent, and on the bottom is efferent. So we have two major branches to the afferent system. And I've called them here conscious sensory and unconscious sensory, but that may not be the right term. because you aren't always aware of what I've called conscious. But what is another way of putting it is the unconscious sensory is what you get from your viscera, like your gut. You are not aware that muscle is tightening or loosening around your gut. In fact, you are unaware of the state of your gut, hopefully, most of the time. So these are the things that are totally unconscious, that you are totally aware of, but they are constantly feeding you information in order to keep you in a steady state. On the other hand, there is the more conscious things, such as smell and taste and vision, and actually things like stretch receptors in your muscle. So the input from your skeletal muscle is actually put in here as well. So the main point, though, is that you are constantly getting information, afferent information, into your central nervous system, both from the outside and the inside. And what do you do with that? Some of the efferent information goes directly to skeletal muscle. And the neurons that take care of this are called the somatic nervous system. And you notice that you don't see any cell bodies here. That's because, as we implied up there, the cell body is in the central nervous system, and then there's a single axon that goes all the way to skeletal muscle. Now, everything else, all the other nerves that control everything else, are called the autonomic nervous system. Or the ANS. So it's afferent versus efferent, somatic versus autonomic. And we have one more big division here, and that is that the autonomic nervous system is divided into two main categories, which are symbolized here as S and PS, but are the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Now, these are physically separate, and they have different structures, and they also serve largely different, but sometimes complementary functions. So let's look at the physical setup briefly, and then consider what they do. So just what we can get out of this picture. That here again, the cell bodies are in the central nervous system. But it takes two neurons to get to the target. In the somatic system, it only took one neuron all the way to the target. But now here, it takes two. And so that's why I've drawn it in two steps here. And then the target is down here. The effector, the gland, the smooth muscle, etc., is down here. Now, all of these cell bodies are found in ganglia because the second cell has its cell body in the peripheral nervous system. Everything on this part, everything outside of the central nervous system, both in and out, is called the peripheral nervous system or the PNS. Now, usually when people talk about the peripheral nervous system, they usually mean the efferent part. They usually mean this part. Okay. So the peripheral nervous system, at least the efferent part of it, is divided into the somatic and the autonomic, which is the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. So the cell bodies of the second, notice that each of these is a two-neuron relay. You have one neuron with a cell body in the central nervous system, and one neuron, a second one, that has its cell body in a ganglion outside. Now, these two ganglia and these two lengths are different on purpose. In general, the ganglia and cell bodies of number two in the sympathetic system are closer to the central nervous system, while those of the parasympathetic are closer to the target. So the relative lengths here with the parasympathetic is long, short versus short, long. And there are accurate pictures of what this actually looks like in your text, in Sadhava and any physiology book, and on the web. Now, before we get into how this works in terms of receptors and neurotransmitters and all that sort of stuff, what gets done with this? We understand what the somatic system does. It moves your skeletal muscles. But what about the parasympathetic and the sympathetic? How do they work? They do everything else. Generally, they have opposite effects. Most of the tissues and organs in your body are innervated, that is, connected to both of these. So there is input, for example, into your heart from both of these. Your heart will beat by itself. Remember the Lowy experiment. But input from the parasympathetic makes it go slower, and input from the sympathetic makes it go faster. Most of your organs and tissues get input from both, but a few of them get only one or the other. For example, the sweat glands get only sympathetic, and your tear glands get only parasympathetic. Now, in general, the sympathetic revs you up, and the parasympathetic calms you down. It is not correct that the sympathetic always turns things on and the parasympathetic always turns things off. Depends what the thing is. The sympathetic turns things either on or off to give you the right response for revving up, usually, and the parasympathetic gives you the right response for calming down. And the way I remember it is para makes you pause. Now, to give an example, the sympathetic makes your heart beat faster, it makes your liver release glucose, it makes your bladder relax. Not contract, but relax. Why? You want to hold more so you don't have to go in the middle of a crisis. Now, on the other hand, the parasympathetic causes your heart rate to go down and it causes your digestion to go up because now there's no emergency, you can digest lunch. Or breakfast, as the case may be. Now, it is not always true, though, that they have opposing effects. Sometimes you need both of them to get something done. And the most famous example of this is sexual arousal in males. And I checked this out with my husband this morning to be sure I had it right. And he says the mnemonic is point and shoot. This is for men only, you understand. Okay. The idea being that you need the parasympathetic to get an erection, and you need the sympathetic in order to ejaculate and have an orgasm. Now, the reason for that is that in order to have an erection, the muscle, smooth muscle around the blood vessels has to relax so the penis can be engorged with blood. And this is due to parasympathetic stimulation. And this is where Viagra comes in. We talked about this, Dr. Feierstein, or I think I did, talked about Viagra, that Viagra increases the relaxation of the smooth muscle cell by inhibiting phosphodiesterase and allowing the signal to relax to stay longer. Notice that smooth muscle can get a relaxed signal. Skeletal muscle cannot. But smooth muscle can get a relaxed signal, not just from a nerve, but from a hormone, which is here nitrous oxide. And so the smooth muscle is given the relaxed signal, the vessels engorge, the arterioles engorge, blood rushes in, and you can get an erection. But to ejaculate, you need sympathetic innervation in order to contract. And it turns out you also need skeletal muscle to contract. So you need the cooperation of all three, in all three parts of the efferent PNS, in order to get a successful ejaculation. And it's not that uncommon that all of these, some or all of these, cooperate to get something done. Okay. So, what is the wiring here? How do we send the signals from one to the next? And that's the handout on B. Now, what we've done is to blow up this picture, just one neuron, and these two with two neurons, and then one special case, which we will explain.
Sure that I did this, right?
Yeah, okay. So what this picture represents is the square is the central nervous system, and here is the body of a neuron. Here's the cell body. And then there's an axon that extends out into the periphery. And in the first case is the somatic, where you have a single neuron, and it goes all the way to the muscle, and then you have a single synapse on the skeletal muscle. That's what we already said. Now, with the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, it starts out the same way, but you have a two-neuron relay. So as we said, with the parasympathetic, number one is relatively long, and number two is relatively short. And with the sympathetic, it's reversed. Number one is relatively short, and number two is relatively long. And this connection, this synapse then, is in a ganglion. So that's what these circles are. And these are separate ganglia. And then you have the target, the effector, whatever it happens to be. The third case is a special case of the sympathetic, and I'll return to it. This is this. Now, we talked last time a lot about receptors and about neurotransmitters, and we said that in the peripheral nervous system, there are two major neurotransmitters, acetylcholine and norepinephrine. And these are the two biggies. And we said that acetylcholine has two types of receptors. It has the nicotinic receptor and the muscarinic receptor. And the nicotinic receptor is the only direct one. That is, it itself is a channel. It's an ionotropic receptor. When you bind acetylcholine, you open the receptor. You open the channel, excuse me, which is part of the receptor. So the only signal you can get here is positive. Open the channel and have an excitatory synapse. That's all you can do. A muscarinic receptor triggers a second messenger. The receptor itself is a G-protein-coupled receptor, and it triggers a second messenger pathway. So depending on the fine points, it can be either excitatory or inhibitory. And we'll get back to norepinephrine in a minute. Now, the very first synapse here is always the same. Now, in the somatic system, the first synapse, that is, outside the central nervous system, the first synapse out here is all you've got. But in the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, you have one synapse, nerve-nerve, and then another synapse, nerve-target. But the first one uses the same neurotransmitter and the same type of receptor. So this is always a nicotinic receptor. So the first neuron from its presynaptic end always releases acetylcholine. It's the same each time. Every place I put a check. And the receptor on the postsynaptic side is always a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor or a nicotinic cholinergic receptor, another name for it. And so this is a direct receptor, meaning you open a channel and you excite. That's all you can do. So it's always excitatory. So we have now three examples of that. In the somatic nervous system, in the parasympathetic at the first, and in the sympathetic at the first synapse. Now, what about the second synapse here? The nerve target synapse. These are not nicotinic. And in general, the sympathetic system uses norepinephrine, with one exception, and the parasympathetic uses acetylcholine. Now, just as an indirect or metabotropic second messenger acetylcholine receptor can either activate or inhibit, so a norepinephrine receptor, which is metabotropic, indirect, generates a second messenger, can either activate or inhibit. We already know that there are alpha and beta receptors, and you can either trigger the IP3 pathway, you can trigger the cyclic AMP pathway, and there are in fact other possibilities. So these can be plus or minus. So this synapse uses acetylcholine, but it uses the other kind of acetylcholine receptor. It uses a muscarinic indirect acetylcholine receptor. So big deal. What's the implication? This means you can either turn things on or you can turn them off. So depending on the fine points of the situation, you can deliver either a plus signal or an inhibitory signal. Either way. For example, acetylcholine causes your heartbeat to decrease, but it causes, pause, slow down, but it causes some glands to secrete more stuff. So we can either have an inhibitory or an excitatory effect. Similarly, the adrenergic synapse that we have in the sympathetic system using norepinephrine, depending on the type of receptor here, whether it's an alpha or a beta, and remember there are many times of alpha and many kinds of beta, can give you either a plus or a minus. And we already gave an example of that the heartbeat goes up, but the smooth muscle around the bladder relaxes. Okay. Now, just one other thing here, we already mentioned that the first synapse out in the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, and therefore the location of the ganglion is different. In one case, it's close to the target, and in one case, it's close to the spinal cord. So in the case of S, the sympathetic, it's close to the spinal cord, and in the case of the parasympathetic with a P, it is proximal, in the sense of close, to its target. Now, for better or worse, you pretty much have to get this picture in your head, because this thing comes up over and over and over and over again in physiology and in discussing what happens. So in the beginning, it's helpful to have this picture handy and to refer to it until it becomes familiar to you. Now, there's one more diagram on this picture that didn't fit on the board, but we want to put that one in. And I'm going to erase the top one and put it in instead. One part of the sympathetic system involves hormones instead of nerves. The sympathetic system, in the standard way, having a short neuron number 1, connects to, in a ganglion, to a second neuron, But in this particular case, the second neuron is very short. And this second neuron does not extend out as wiring to some target. Instead, this special neuron, which is in the adrenal medulla, releases epinephrine into the blood. So, this is a case of what you would call a neuroendocrine. That is neuro, it's released by a nerve cell. It's a compound similar to other neurotransmitters. But instead of going locally and hitting a target on the other half of the synapse, the compound is released into the blood like a hormone, travels around, and hits all of its various targets. The idea is that when you have stress, both of these go into a play. The nerves that go to the right targets specifically activate the right glands and tissues. In addition, when you have stress or you need to wake up or to do things a little faster, you release epinephrine into the blood, and that reaches places where the wiring doesn't go. It's slower, but it gets to many additional tissues that don't have a specific landline going back to the sympathetic. And so the epinephrine from the blood and the norepinephrine at synapses have a similar effect of juicing things up. And so this goes through the blood to many different targets. Now, we mentioned before that norepinephrine and epinephrine are very similar. They differ by one methyl group. And in general, when they're released, you usually get a mixture, but primarily epinephrine as a hormone and primarily norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Now, there's one other piece of terminology that you have to know to understand all of this. Whenever you have a single synapse, you talk about the presynaptic cell and the postsynaptic cell. But when you have a two-cell relay like this, in the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, you need to keep straight which is cell number one and which is cell number two. And instead of calling them number one and number two, they're normally called the preganglionic neuron and the postganglionic neuron. So in the parasympathetic, the preganglionic is longer and the postganglionic is shorter, and it's vice versa in the sympathetic. Now, for the remainder of the time, I want to switch from talking about muscles to talking about nerves and start talking about the major effector, which is muscle. But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions. Yes? What neurotransmitters are being sent in the preganglionic? We said that the first synapse out is always the same. So this is going to be the same as at a nerve-muscle junction. This is the same as in the somatic. So what's the neurotransmitter? What is it? Yeah, you got to look it up. It's actually acetylcholine. It's this one. So it's this kind. It's acetylcholine with a nicotinic receptor, whether you're talking about the somatic system or the ganglion synapse, or whether you're talking about here either with the adrenal medulla. They're all the same. Yeah?
What is the functional name for the location of the relay?
What is the functional reason for the locations of the relay? I don't know the answer to that. There may be some rational explanation for why it pays to have it with the different lengths, but I don't know what it is. Yeah?
Just going back to this picture here of the CNS, should we consider the eyes part of the CNS or part of the sensory system?
What you consider the eye part of, I think, is a matter of preference. I'll leave that to the neuroscientists. I would think you would consider the receptors to be part of the peripheral, but actually the whole thing is really part of your brain. I will repeat one more time the famous adage that the cells do not know about our classification system. The organs don't know either. Yeah.
Can one synapse, one specific synapse, change if it's positive or negative?
Can one specific synapse change if it's positive or negative? Well, what determines whether a synapse is positive or negative is the kind of receptor you have, and therefore the kind of channel that you open. And that is a structural part of the synapse which remains constant. Now, there are some complications, but that's the basic answer is no. Okay? All right. So now we want to consider a little bit more about what happens at this end. And when you have a skeletal muscle or a cardiac muscle or a smooth muscle, what does it look like and how does a nerve get it to contract? So for this, you need the final handout. On which we have pictures of the three major types of muscle. So we have here a picture of the three kinds, which are skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. Now in your pictures, I think it goes skeletal, cardiac, smooth. Now, what is common to all of these, of course, is that they contract. And they all do it by having the proteins actin and myosin, which we've already met. And in all cases, the way it works is that the two proteins slide relative to each other. Neither protein gets longer or shorter, but the two proteins slide relative. And I'll bring a little demo next time, but I forgot it this day. So the way they slide is they form sort of bridge between them. Exactly the fine points of that depend on what kind of muscle it is. But they have to attach temporarily to hold the tension, to hold the contraction. And so for all of them, you have what is called a bridge cycle. Now, it's important to realize that in the notes, I've separated some of the features, and I may not cover it exactly in the same order, but I'll try. So there is a bridge cycle in all three cases in which actin and myosin connect, release. And in all cases, this is driven by using ATP. ATP provides the energy to drive the bridge cycle. Now, almost all of these are electrical, all of them are electrically excitable. That is, the membrane of a muscle can carry out an action potential just like the membrane of an axon, meaning that the membrane of the cells contains voltage-gated channels so you can generate an action potential. Now, there are a few cases of smooth muscle whose contraction does not involve action potentials. But usually what happens is an action potential is generated in the muscle membrane, and that generates contraction, usually. So stimulation by either a nerve or a hormone, as the case may be, causes the action potential. And that generally leads to a rise in calcium. All three types of muscle use calcium to trigger contraction. Now, exactly how they do it, where the calcium comes from, outside the cell, from the ER, some combination, and what proteins the calcium binds to, and whether it requires calmodulin, all that sort of stuff is different. And we understand all the fine points in skeletal muscle and most of them in smooth muscle and cardiac. And we're not going to talk about those molecular details today. We'll do that after development. But in almost all cases, the action potential causes a release of calcium, and that triggers the bridge cycle. So this is what is generally common to all of them. But they're really very different in structure and in function. So the structures are shown on the handout. And I brought along some models to make some of this a little bit clearer. That one of the obvious things you see from looking at this picture is the total difference in size. That smooth muscle cells are much, much smaller than skeletal muscle cells. And depending on how you look at it, a cardiac muscle fiber is somewhere in between. Now, the reason for this is that smooth muscle is made up of ordinary sized individual cells. Now, there are two variants on this. Each cell can contract completely separately, or the cells can be connected by gap junctions. And if they're connected by gap junctions, then that means they're electrically coupled. So that means ions can flow from one to the other, and if one of them has an ion change, all of them will, and they'll all contract as a unit. So smooth muscle is divided into two types. In your actual notes, this is mentioned further on, so you don't have to worry about writing it down exactly, but that there are two kinds of smooth muscle depending on whether each individual cell does it by itself or whether they do it as a group. Skeletal muscle, on the other hand, the cells are fused. So what is called a muscle fiber or a single cell is really multinucleate. It's what results during development from the fusion of many individual cells. So they have a common cytoplasm, which is stuffed with actin and myosin. And then on the sides, you have these nuclei, as shown in your picture. Now, the difference in size is really striking. I brought some models here. If this is sort of an ordinary size cell, and I probably should have brought a smaller roll, probably something about half the size of this, but they didn't have the right kind of roll. So something like a smooth muscle cell is like this one, and a skeletal muscle cell is like this. It's the result of the fusion of multiple cells, and it's very large. Now, what gives with cardiac muscle? We know that in your section of your heart, like an atrium, the entire section in the atrium or the ventricle contracts as a unit. And the reason for this is that the cells are not completely fused, but they are very tightly fused at the ends. So that although you have individual cells, they are all electrically coupled. So you have one cell has a special structures at the end, and this cell has complementary ones, and there are desmosomes here making for a very strong connection and gap junctions. Just as certain smooth muscle has gap junctions, cardiac muscle has lots of gap junctions, so that if the ion changes flow, changes the ionic composition of this cell, it will change the electrical composition of that cell, and the entire unit will contract together. And so you have these special structures at the end of each cell. And they're called intercalated discs, which is written on your handout. And so effectively, when you look, they don't look quite like separate cells because they are so tightly joined, although each one has its nucleus. And I have a model sort of for the joint. It's sort of something like this. So the intercalated disc is something like that on the end of one cardiac muscle cell, and the end of the other cardiac muscle cell is like that. And so they come together very tightly. And they interdigitate like this. And they're electrically coupled because of the gap junctions and tightly connected because of the desmosomes. Now, there's clearly a major difference in size and in whether they're entirely fused or just at the ends. It's also clear from looking that two of these are striped and one of them isn't. Cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle are said to be striated. These two. This is obvious from the picture. But smooth muscle is not. Now, what causes this? All muscle has inside actin and myosin arranged so that they can slide past each other. In the case of both cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle, the actin and the myosin are arranged in very regular tight register. And since they're arranged in an extremely regular way, the result is to give that striped pattern. So we'll go into the details another time, or you can look in the book, but you have something that looks sort of like this for the arrangement of actin and myosin. This one's the myosin for those of you who are curious. And these two slide relative to each other. But you have each little actin myosin piece stacked up on another. You have them arranged in order and stacked up on each other. In smooth muscle, the arrangement is much different. The arrangement is not so tight and packed. This arrangement is called a sarcomere. But in the smooth muscle, the way it's arranged is called a bundle. So it looks more like this. And they're much thinner because you have one bundle like this, while with sarcomeres, you have many of them in a line and then many of them piled on top of each other. In fact, a muscle cell inside, a skeletal muscle cell inside, looks something like this. Maybe it'll be a little clearer if I take it out. Inside a skeletal muscle cell, you have these fibers or fibrils. And each of these is a regular arrangement of sarcomeres, a regular arrangement of actin and myosin packed in three dimensions. And then these are stacked on top of each other. So when you look inside of a skeletal muscle cell, it looks like this. You see these individual fibers. And then the nuclei are out here. We will go over the exact structure of how you pack the actin and myosin into one of these later, but not today. I wanted to bring this, I wanted to get most of the bread out of the way today, because the next time I'm lecturing is the day before Passover. I may bring the sticks back, but then you have to eat them. Well, the evening class has to eat. Okay. So let's see what other features here we want to be sure to mention. All of these cells contract when they get stimulation, but what's the difference? We already know that with skeletal muscle, there's only one kind of message it can get, and that's contract. Either it gets no message and it relaxes, or it gets a contraction message. And that's because the only thing that connects to skeletal muscle is one of these neurons of the somatic nervous system. The only input to skeletal muscle is nervous. On the other hand, with smooth muscle, there are nerves to smooth muscle, both parasympathetic and sympathetic. And in addition, there are hormone receptors on much smooth muscle. So smooth muscle gets input from many sources, not from the somatic nervous system, but from the sympathetic or the parasympathetic and a whole collection of hormones. And the signal can either be to contract or it can be to relax. Now, what excites cardiac muscle? You already know, I think, from the Lowy experiment that Dr. Feierstein talked about, that if you take an isolated heart and you put it in a beaker, it will still beat. A heart generates its own internal rhythm. But in addition, it gets input from the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, which either speed it up or slow it down. And that's because some of the cells of the heart, and actually some smooth muscle cells as well, have what is called pacemaker activity. And that is outlined on the last handout. There's a little graph we're used to thinking about action potentials being generated because of an IPSP or enough EPSPs come in to bring the cell to threshold. Stimulus from the outside in the form of neurotransmitter is required to bring a cell to threshold, open voltage-gated channels, and generate an action potential. But in what are called pacemaker cells, this is not true. Pacemaker cells, which are found in the heart and in some smooth muscle, depolarize very slowly by themselves. So they have channels which open. And due to the passage of ions through those channels, they gradually depolarize, hit threshold, and fire an action potential. And then they return to baseline. But then as soon as they return to baseline, the channels open again, and they get a slow leakage until they fire. So without any external input, these cells will fire in a regular pattern. Exactly what moves is not clear, but how could you depolarize? Either you need more plus in or less, or more minus. More is probably you get either calcium or sodium in or less potassium out. It's not exactly clear what's going on here. But due to a change in ion flow, the cell gradually depolarizes and kicks itself off. But we know that input from the parasympathetic or the sympathetic can slow this down or speed it up. And the way it does that is the neurotransmitters from the parasympathetic or the sympathetic influence the opening and closing of these channels. If these channels are more open, the cell depolarizes faster at its less interval between action potentials. If the channels are more closed so that the ions can't leak, then it takes longer for the cell to depolarize and it has a slower firing. Now, there's one other thing shown on this handout, and this is the smooth muscle structure that at the skeletal muscle nerve synapse, there is a very specialized structure, such as shown on handout 14. But in smooth muscle, there is a less complicated structure both on the presynaptic side and the postsynaptic side. Now, one more thing I want to say to wrap this up is that you might ask, why do you have smooth muscle? Skeletal muscle looks like it's the heavy lifter here. It looks like it can do whatever you want. Smooth muscle is its poor relative. It's sort of weak and wimpy, and what do you need it for? Smooth muscle is specialized for maintaining an intermediate level contraction over long periods with relatively low input of ATP. So it allows you to hold in your guts and to hold in your arterioles over long periods without spending a lot of energy. And that's partially because in its bridge cycle, it can hold on longer before it has to break and reform. Now, the next week, we're going to do development. The schedule is a little odd, partially because Dr. Feierstein and I and Dr. Heiklin and the holidays all got in that vacation. There was only one way we could sort of all squeeze it in. So we're going to take a break from the nerves and talk about not how the multi-cellular organism works, but how you build one and how you get cells to specialize. And then after that, we'll come back and wrap up some of the molecular details of muscle functions.